Now, we don't necessarily choose who our relatives are, but in some cases, like my next guest, that is certainly okay, especially if you're the fifth great-niece of none other than Jane Austen. Imagine for a moment you have walked the corridors where Jane has walked. You have sat at the table and even eaten from the same china and, dare I say, brought it into the studio with you as Jane Austen. Well, my next guest can say exactly that. Caroline Jane Knight is the last Austen descendant to grow up at Chawton House, where Jane lived and wrote as well. But now, Caroline, you have written your story, Jane and Me. Welcome to Afternoons.
Thank you.
I'll get you to come a little closer to your mic for me. Thank you. Now, I mentioned the china, Jane Austen's china, and you passed it to me and I had a little heart attack because it is sitting right in front of us. Are you telling me that Jane Austen has eaten from that plate?
Absolutely. So this dinner service was ordered from Wedgwood, Jane and her brother Edward, who's actually my fourth great grandfather. So Jane and Edward went to the Wedgwood showroom on the 16th of September 1813, and they ordered a dinner service to be made just for our family, which is exactly what happened. Thankfully, it survived, and it was actually given to my parents as a wedding present from my grandfather.
So, and how have you managed to bring it here into the studios of ABC? Does anyone know you have it?
No, I'm not really quite sure. So in actual fact, most of it, so about 90 to 100 pieces survive today, and most of it is in very, very safe keeping in the UK. I mean, anything that Jane actually, she wrote about this dinner service. So we have a letter where she actually says and describes the design and describes going to Wedgwood, which is obviously just fantastic. But there isn't, I mean, Jane led a very modest life, and there's actually not that much, you know, physical objects that she, that we know that she knew that she, and so there's no doubt she ate off it. So most of it is absolutely under lock and key in the UK and safekeeping. But my parents, because of the work I do, raising money for literacy and you know, for the Jane Austen Literacy Foundation, I persuaded them very kindly to loan me two pieces, which I take around with me.
And the fact that it's not wrapped in bubble wrap and has a little glass case around it, it just literally just kind of, you know,
oh, it's in bubble wrap in the box, but yes.
Well, people will be able to look at it and celebrate all things Jane Austen, given that there is the Jane Austen Winter Fest, which is on, part of the reason, of course, while you're here. But let's talk a little bit about the house that you grew up in. You lived there until you were 18. This is in Chawton. It is the house of Jane Austen. I mean, what was it like walking the halls and sitting on the table?
So the house itself, Chawton House, is 400 years old, and it was built by John Knight in 1583. So I'm obviously a knight, so I'm 17th generation to have lived there. But in those 17 generations, every now and then the squire can't have children. So if that's the case, they adopt a nephew or a cousin or somebody to become the heir. And at the end of the 18th century, that's exactly what happened. The knights couldn't have children, and Edward Austen was chosen as the heir on the condition he changed his name to Knight, which is why we're knights. And that's also why, or how, you get these names lasting for centuries and centuries is actually because, as I said, people change their name to inherit. But growing up in, I mean, growing up in 400 years of my own history is a phenomenal experience, and something that's, you know, quite difficult, of course, to articulate to somebody else how that makes me, you know, how strongly I feel connected to it. And I grew up in a place where every single tree I could see, every single brick, every single bit of oak panelling, everything had been put there by my family. And my family's mark is literally all over the place. Now, Jane Austen actually didn't live in the same house as I did. I lived in the big house at Chawton, what she called the Great House. Jane actually lived in a little cottage on the estate, so 400 metres from the door of the Great House. But the Great House was a place that she was in all the time. It was her brother's house. And as you said in your introduction, I ate from the same dining room table as her. We've eaten from the same china, the same family library.
Do you feel like you have a normal upbringing then? If you're sitting at a table, is part of your brain going, I wonder if Jane sat here?
It's something that where when I was a child, because I grew up in such incredible history, Jane Austen was part of that, and she was a very important part of it and very influential. And to grow up as a young girl, having these amazing stories of this woman who didn't give up, who followed her dream, who, despite what everyone around her or certainly society was saying, she was determined. She knew what she was born to be, and she was born to be a writer, and she didn't give up. That is such an empowering, empowering message to have from birth. I mean, I didn't have a first day with Jane Austen. I was born there, born into it. But one thing that Jane, so not only, as I said, was she an incredibly inspirational woman, she also was sort of part of the business of the estate, because we had thousands of visitors every year who, just as they do today, make the pilgrimage to Chawton to see where Pride and Prejudice comes from, to see where the books come from. So Jane was also somebody that was talked about all the time. And, you know, Mr. Darcy and Lizzie are characters that I've known from, again, being a toddler, because, of course, tourists even back then. And that was before Colin Firth, I have to say, we lived there. So a very different sort of Austin community, if you like.
And so despite the, you know, obvious lack of physical presence of Jane Austen, and this is, I guess, it's almost a spiritual type question, do you feel her presence? Do you hear her? Do you see her?
Yes, although that has... Again, that's actually changed over the years as I mean, Jane Austen today has become an absolute global phenomenon. And Jane Austen has, in a way, sort of split into two separate things. You've got Jane Austen, a real live woman who's a member of my family, who's you know, somebody that was very, very well loved by her family, by all accounts, not only great fun and very spirited and so funny and such wit, but also strong and determined and as I said, not afraid to shy away from what she needed to. But then you've got Jane Austen, the brand. You've got this global megastar, as I said, who now, you know, her name titles festivals and all sorts of things all over the world. That's actually a slightly different thing. That's not actually her
anymore.
And do you
think she would be happy with that?
I think there are some things that she'd absolutely relish in, I'm sure, and I think she'd probably laugh at, in some ways, the ridiculousness of some of what goes on in her name. I think she'd find a sense of humour about it. I think there's probably some things that she might shudder about, but I think overall, I think she'd probably find it quite amusing.
Caroline Jane Knight is with you. She's the last Austen descendant to grow up at Chawton House, where Jane lived and wrote. Caroline is also the author of Jane and Me, My Austen Heritage, the founder of the Jane Austen Literacy Foundation, and is here for the Jane Austen Winter Festival, which is on until the 31st of July. It is in Altona. I'll give you some dates at the end. 1-300-222-774. Maybe there is a book or a memory or a question that you would like to put to Caroline. You can also text 0437 774 774. What about some of the more recent adaptations? How contemporary it's become? You know, as a descendant, as someone that lives and breathes the work of Jane Austen, how do you feel about those?
Well, it all obviously 1995 was when we had, you know, we had the Colin Firth version of Pride and Prejudice, and we had Emma Thompson's Sense and Sensibility, both of which were hugely successful. Although, of course, Pride and Prejudice is by far the most sort of iconic piece that's been done. And what they both proved is that there is a big market for Austen work. And we've actually, we're now into, I think we've just had our 71st movie or TV series release that is based on Jane Austen's work. Not all of it is obviously necessarily to my personal taste.
And so there is never, has to be any clearance from the family, from the estate?
Her work was out of copyright in the middle of the 18th century.
So no.
Nobody earns anything. There are no royalties to pay. Jane's work, image, absolutely everything about her is used for free by everybody.
Isn't that incredible?
It's certainly not what people expect.
No.
And somewhere along the line, I think people expect that, you know, expect that probably the Austen family or lots of money has been generated by Jane's work, and it just hasn't.
So is that a little bit of a blessing or a curse to a certain degree?
Oh, it's probably both. I mean, I guess... The negative, if you want to look at it like that, is that actually for a, and I'm going to use the word brand again, but for a brand that is that massive, no one controls it. No one, yep. which means that actually the community across the world is phenomenally fragmented. And it's actually, as I said, no one is in control of it. But on the other hand, that gives everybody the freedom to do what they want, enjoy it like they do. And there are movies, and I'll just use an example of Pride and Prejudice and Zombies that was out 2 years ago.
A natural connection.
Exactly, natural connection. Now, that isn't necessarily something that was my taste, but I'm not the target audience. But in, you know, because I still have a professional career as well, and I still work in marketing. And when I'm in marketing sort of offices, you know, I'm surrounded by young people who saw it because it was a zombie movie. Now, that was their first introduction to Jane Austen. So I just have to think, well, everything that happens is reaching somebody new, is introducing something, you know, somebody new to Jane Austen. And when I was a child, as I said, because it was before Colin Firth, the vast majority of visitors to Chawton, I mean, over 90% of them were reading Jane's original text. That is what the audience was. Now, it's completely different. I mean, there is a massive, massive community of people across the world that may never have read Jane's original text. They love her work in movie form.
And zombie form.
And increasingly, I do a lot of speaking events, and increasingly at events, the amount of people that, you know, when I ask the question, you know, how did you first get to know about Jane and her work? Nowadays, I think more than 50% of people say to me, I saw a movie. I saw Pride and Prejudice, the BBC version, but that has led on to them reading her work. It has been what the entry to them.
A lot of it sounds so perfect for what she stood for as a woman and as a writer, that that's sort of the way that it has worked. And I know you're also the founder of the Jane Austen Literacy Foundation. What work does that foundation do? What do you strive to do there?
So the foundation is very, very simple idea. So when we left Chawton when I was 18, I was quite upset to be leaving, to be honest. I found it incredibly difficult to be leaving all my ancestors behind and our heritage. And I didn't tell anybody for about 25 years who I was. So my entire professional career, my entire adult life, I moved away from the area and I just didn't tell anybody. I didn't want to talk about it because it was something that to me was just loss and grief. And so it wasn't a story that actually for most of my adult life I've taken much pleasure from.
But because you moved out of the house at 18.
Yes, yeah, at 18. And I think because my identity was so, so entrenched in Chawton, and as I said, the connection and the sense of belonging I feel to that place is so strong, I personally struggled with creating an adult identity outside of it.
So how did you, sorry to interrupt you there, because we will get to the foundation in a moment then. If you didn't tell anyone, if you kept this almost a secret for 25 years, do people then believe you if you say, well, actually, I am the last descendant to have lived in Chawton House. I am the fifth generation granddaughter, niece, sorry. Niece. How do people just go, yeah, right, anyway?
Well, no, because of course I've got a lifetime of photographs from being a child. I mean, I have got.
Did you have to bust them out though to prove it?
Well, I tell you what, and this was so funny. When I decided, so what actually made me decide that I would change this secret and actually use it for some good, use my heritage for the foundation, and was in 2013, was the 200 year anniversary of the publishing of Pride and Prejudice. And all of a sudden, I mean, you know, I'd actually at that time I was living in Australia and running a business here. And one of the things I loved about Australia at that time is that actually Jane Austen wasn't really in popular culture. I mean, I'm sure lots of people were reading her privately, but there weren't many Jane Austen events going on. It just wasn't really there. And for me at the time, that suited me very well. But then 2013, as I said, with the anniversary, that just changed. And all of a sudden, even here in Melbourne, everywhere I turned, I was seeing a Jane Austen talk at the Johnson Collection, or I was seeing the Jane Austen Tea Room opened in Essendon. You know, all of these things were happening, and I sort of got to a realization that I wasn't going to be. I mean, her fame is just so massive that I wasn't going to be able to avoid her. I can't pretend it didn't happen. But the first time I actually told Amanda, who's a very close friend of mine and went on to be the co-founder of the foundation, the first time I decided to tell her, and she was the first person I told. It's so silly. Because I was so nervous, I prepared a PowerPoint presentation and I went along and met her in a cafe with a laptop. I literally took her through. So even in that first introduction, I was obviously showing pictures of the house, me as a child, all of our family events. So of course, there was no question.
There was no doubt.
No question about what I was saying at all.
And did it feel nice to be able to then take some of that ownership back and that love? Because obviously you're so passionate and you lived within Chawton House and lived and breathed it, and then you were almost grieving for 25 years. Did you feel lighter? Did it feel like
not
a coming
at the beginning.
Home?
And right at the beginning, to be quite honest, it was terrifying because I knew that I was, and obviously we all have our own stuff. We all have our own personal things. And for me, this was my biggest demon to sort of solve.
It's pretty big.
And after 25 years, I hadn't moved at all. I mean, for me, it was as fresh as the day we'd left. Yeah. I hadn't dealt with it at all. And part of the reason that I decided to do three things. Part of the reason I decided to launch the foundation was because it gave me, other than the fact it's just a good idea to raise money for literacy, it gives me a really positive focus for all of this. And I thought, by this point, I said in 2013, I would have been 43. And I thought at this point, I have to change this narrative. I have to change this story from being something that isn't a source of comfort for me or isn't something joyful. I have to change that. And the foundation was a way of doing that. I also realised that, I mean, our history in Chawton, the Knight family history, is documented from 1307. And it stops at about 1911 because that's when things started going wrong in terms of the financial stability of the estate and the family. And I think when things start to go wrong, people stop writing about it.
Let's just skip this.
Exactly.
Bit.
So I also became very aware that I am sitting on the absolute first-hand knowledge of Chawton House as the home of the Austin family. And if I don't tell the end of the story, nobody's going to tell it. So I also sort of felt that responsibility. The other thing I decided to do, which I have become quite an advocate of, is I went and got a counsellor. And I sat with somebody for 3 years while I wrote my book to just sort of work through it.
What a privilege it would be for them as well to be there and to be a part of that. Well, that book is Jane and Me, My Austen Heritage. As you said, you are the founder of the Jane Austen Literacy Foundation. And Jane Austen is just so loved all around the globe. But here, until the 31st of July in Altona, the Jane Austen Winter Festival is on. The money there is also being raised for Indigenous literacy projects as well. So you can go along to one of these events. You can celebrate everything Jane Austen and relish, as many of us do. But before you go, Caroline, I have to ask you, as someone that is based entirely, whose heritage is based entirely on British culture, how do you feel about Boris Johnson about to be labelled the next British Prime Minister?
It's something that 5 years ago it would have been impossible to imagine that Boris Johnson would be the It really was that he would be the Prime Minister. I think that England has, or Britain has, been through such an extraordinary 3 years, and things are so off the rails. I mean, it's just been limbo for a couple of years and just getting worse and worse and worse, that I think that most of us are now at the point of just wanting something to happen.
And what sort of Prime Minister do you think he'll make?
I think he'll be a bit more bullish. I think he'll do what he wants to do.
Really?
And it's one of those things that whilst I think, as I said, I think a couple of years ago, the country's lacking hope. The country's lacking direction. The country's lacking action. And sometimes I think you can get to a point where even action in the wrong direction is better than none at all. And I think England is at that point. And whilst there's lots of discussion about Brexit should be cancelled and we should go back to to stay with the EU, we are so far down a path. I don't know how we do that without losing so much power with the EU. You know, I think we've got to a point now that either direction is so problematic. We just need to follow one. And I probably think that Boris is going to have a better chance through his own personality and the way that he does business.
He certainly does have
at least
a personality.
Doing something.
And is Boris a common name in Britain?
No, other than Boris Becker, who obviously isn't English and a tennis player. I don't know anyone else called Boris. No,
okay.
It's not an English name.
Caroline Jane Knight, thank you so much for joining me on Afternoons. Could you please put that piece of china away carefully? The more animated we got with our conversation, the more I was panicking that I was going to hear a crack. Thank you so much for joining me on Afternoons.